pretty goddamned cloying after a while. I haven't been able to look a donut in the face ever since. In an interview with Douglas Winter for Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, Tabitha recalled, "I was devastated to get out of college and find that no one wanted to hire me. I had managed to work all the way through college and make money, only to discover suddenly that my BA was worth absolutely nothing." Meanwhile, Stephen spent his nights finishing Getting It On, a novel for which he had high hopes. A sale meant welcome money, more than he'd ever earned as a laborer. After reading a suspense novel he borrowed from the library, Lauren Singer's The Parallax View, King said that it reminded me of my own work, and wrote a query letter to Singer's editor at Doubleday. But it didn't go to that editor, who was out sick at the time. It went instead to another Doubleday editor, William G. Thompson, who asked to see the manuscript. As King recalled in an essay on becoming a brand name, "I sent him the book. He liked it a great deal and tried to get Doubleday to publish it. Doubleday declined, a painful blow for me, because I had been allowed to entertain some hope for an extraordinarily long time, and had rewritten the book a third time, trying to bring it in line with what Doubleday's publishing board would accept." Thompson delivered the blow as kindly as possible, but it was still a blow. With both Kings underemployed and their impoverished incomes supplemented with an occasional fiction sale, money was very tight. When a position as an English teacher became available in nearby Hampton, Stephen grabbed the lifeline. Because Hampton is southwest of Bangor, and the Kings lived north of Bangor, it made little sense to stay in the college town. To save on commuting costs, after all, gas cost 25 cents a gallon, the Kings moved to downtown Bangor's Stone Street and defrayed costs by taking on a boarder, Chris Chesley, who was in his first year at the University of Maine at Orno. Hope is a good thing. Teaching is historically a woman's profession, and as such does not pay well in comparison to other professional jobs. Even today, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics report, February 2013, 82% of elementary and middle school teachers are women. The same report states that women, on the whole, earn 82% of what men earn. In other words, King had chosen a profession that traditionally doesn't pay well. King's salary as an English teacher at Hampton Academy was $6,400. His fear in taking the job was that he'd find himself stuck like a fly caught on flypaper. He'd spend the rest of his life teaching instead of doing what he loved and what he believed he was born to do, write fiction. If that happened, it would be King's worst fears realized. But with no prospect of any book sales on the horizon and no other professional job in the offing, Stephen King took the teaching job. He was gainfully employed, but he knew it came at a cost. It'd take precious time away from writing. A natural teacher, like his mother, he had a dramatic flair and enjoyed public speaking. Stephen King nonetheless found the teaching experience draining. He described it metaphorically. It was as if he was a car battery and the students were constantly draining him by attaching jumper cables. Moreover, taking papers home to grade and preparing for classes took up precious time in the evenings and weekends. Psychically drained, King forced himself to carve out precious time in the evenings to write fiction. He did so under difficult circumstances. Typing on his wife's portable Olivetti with its square-lettered typeface, hammering away so hard at it that his fingerprints were eventually embedded in its keys. Because of his low salary, King supplemented his income in the summers by working at the New Franklin Laundry in Bangor for $60 a week. His wife still worked at the donut shop, stealing her own tips because sharing them, as per the restaurant's policy, meant she'd take home even less, and they needed every thin dime. Between their combined incomes, They simply couldn't get ahead financially. Things had to change. Had to. It meant Stephen would have to keep pursuing his dream as a writer, because his failure meant that they were condemned to live the lives of the working poor, like other people they knew. They'd be living their hard-scrabble existence for the foreseeable future. A grim slog. The following year proved to be no different financially. If anything, it was worse, because of more child-related bills. They had their second child, Joseph Hillstrom King, who was born on June 4, 1972. Still a teacher at Hampton Academy and writing on the side, Stephen, at least, was able to sell four more stories to Cavalier that year, but once again he had pinned hopes on a Hail Mary pass, hoping to sell a book to Doubleday written mostly over a Christmas vacation. The novel, Running Man, was science fiction. But the manuscript shot back within a week, albeit with an invitation for King to try again. Living in a trailer park in Herman, Maine, money was so tight that they had the phone taken out. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King recalled those times as the lowest point in his life. If anyone should ever ask you, Herman, Maine is not Paris, France. It is not even Twin Forks, Idaho. If it is not the pits, it is very close. But in a Playboy interview, he was less polite, saying that if it wasn't the asshole of the universe, it was within farting distance of it, which raised a big stink with the town's officials. In December, with a slowly dying Buick in their driveway and writer's block brought on by King's anxieties about money, King, lacking any fresh ideas, decided to rewrite a story he had begun a previous summer about an outsider named Carrie White. When pushed beyond her breaking point by her high school peers, she used her latent psychic talent to push back hard, laying waste to the town. To Stephen King, time was money. In other words, he couldn't afford to spend what little free time he had in writing a story that wasn't going to sell immediately to his editor at Cavalier. Frustrated with the beginning of the short story, set in a girl's locker room, he balled up the first few pages and tossed them in the trash. But Tabitha retrieved them, smoothed the wrinkled paper, and began reading. She liked what she read, and encouraged Stephen to carry on. He protested that he didn't know anything about what went on in a girl's locker room in high school. She countered, saying that she'd help him, and she did. Stephen carried on. The problem, though, was that King had hoped to sell it to Cavalier, but the short story had morphed into a novella of 25,000 words, which was far too long for the magazine. Lacking any other story ideas, though, King figured that he was in for a penny, in for a pound, and began rewriting and adding bogus documentation to boost the wordage to 50,000 words. Cavalier as a potential market was out of the question, but perhaps Bill Thompson at Doubleday might possibly be interested in a short novel, since they had asked for another submission. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King wrote, "My considered opinion was that I had written the world's all-time loser. The only thing I could say about Carrie was that it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that for some crazy reason, my wife liked it better than anything I'd written before." 12. A Good Angel. Cavalier editor Nye Wilden. The mechanics of writing fiction back in the days before word processors and computers was no simple matter. From start to finish, it was tedious work. And if the editor who received the manuscript decided changes were warranted, it meant retyping the manuscript again. Back in the early to mid-70s, when King was submitting to Cavalier, the best typewriter on the market was the IBM Selectric. So named because you could select different typefaces by changing the type element, commonly called a golf ball. An electric, state-of-the-art typewriter. The Selectric was the preferred machine of its day, found mostly in the offices of Fortune 500 companies that could afford it. Though King, a two-finger typist, would have loved to have one, he could not afford it. He had instead hammered out stories on his wife's inexpensive electric typewriter, a Smith Corona. When King broke in with his first sale at Cavalier, it opened the door to further submissions, to the point where King became a regular and developed a working relationship with an associate editor, Nye Wilden. But getting paid was no easy matter. Magazines like Cavalier paid on publication, not on acceptance, so it meant waiting months. In contrast, Playboy paid up to $2,000 on acceptance, which made it a popular market for professional writers. Though Cavalier sold principally on its sexy contents, King never submitted any erotic fiction because he couldn't write it without cracking up. When he was at the University of Maine at Orono, and money was very tight, he attempted to write erotica to pay the bills and began a short story about a pair of sexy twin girls in a birdbath, but he did not complete it. He'd leave erotica to other writers who were more bound to please. In his essay, On Becoming a Brand Name, Stephen King characterized Wilden as a good angel. It was Wilden at Cavalier who read, encouraged, and bought Stephen King's short fiction pieces, most of which were subsequently collected in Night Shift. King finally broke in at Cavalier in its October 1970 issue with his story Graveyard Shift, which appeared under the byline of Steve King. This in-your-face story with artwork accompanying the piece made no bones about its subject matter. The artwork depicted an extreme close-up of a rat's face. It recalls Winston Smith's nightmare in George Orwell's 1984, when Smith, his head immobilized, sees a rat in a cage staring him in the face, separated only by a thin wire gate. In 2014, in an interview on People TV with actress Joan Allen of A Good Marriage, King cited 1984 as the scariest book he had ever read precisely because of that scene. As with Glass Floor, his first professional publication in Startling Mystery Stories, King's name was cover-worthy for the October 1970 edition of Cavalier. What did help sell copies was the sexy photo on the cover, which featured a color photo of a naked redhead seductively smiling at the reader. When King finally saw his story in print, it was sandwiched in between photos of naked women and ads for marital aids and X-rated movies and photos. Anyone interested in fiction would not think of Cavalier as a place to find it, unlike Heff's Playboy, which had a deserved reputation for literary excellence. In Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, Winter writes that he expressed surprise when he encountered King's fiction for the first time in Cavalier. While waiting to get his shoes shined at an old-fashioned shoeshine parlor, he turned to the reading material at hand, a random selection of men's magazines. The magazine covers, he wrote, and most of the revealing photographs had been torn away, leaving the customer with the even more dubious textual content. But there was a diamond in the rough. He pulled out an issue of Cavalier with a King story and was struck by its excellence. It captured me, there in a decaying and now long ago demolished shoeshine parlor in downtown St. Louis, taking me away to a strawberry spring in New England, where horror walked in every shadow. It was his first encounter with King, and it changed his life. The story he had read was Strawberry Spring, and he immediately became a King fan. King's sale to Cavalier was no accident. Lacking a literary agent to do the legwork, King did what every other smart writer does. He did his own homework. In The Horror Market Writer and the Ten Bears, published in Writer's Digest in 1973, and reprinted in Secret Windows, King lays out the nuts and bolts of submitting professionally, a process he dutifully followed when submitting Graveyard Shift to Wilden. He didn't add gratuitous sex just because it was for a men's magazine. He studied the market by reading what the magazine published. He took a critical eye to his own work to improve it. He admonished against being influenced by Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft because both were Rococo stylists. Pointed out that a story's word length should fall within the published guidelines, and said that rewriting, though painful, was necessary. Even though another editor, Robert Lowndes, was first to publish King professionally in Startling Mystery Stories, Cavalier gave King a more mainstream showcase and went on to publish numerous short stories by King, enough to help him fill a book, Night Shift, published in 1978. As King pointed out over the years, those checks from Cavalier often appeared just in time to help stave off the wolves at the door at a time when every dollar counted. Breaking editorial policy just for King, Wilden, upon request, would send King a check on acceptance. That's what guardian angels do. And that's what he did for the Kings, who have never forgotten his kindness. What follows from the 1989 edition of The Stephen King Companion is Nye Wilden's view of a young, talented, 20-something writer whom he knew was destined for bigger and better things. 1988. Graveyard Shift was King's first story published by us, and I Am the Doorway was the second. As an editor for a men's magazine which dealt primarily in sexually or erotically oriented fiction, Stephen's story was an exception, and had it been written by someone less talented, it probably wouldn't have made it. But to be honest, I was very impressed, sensing that there was something very out of the ordinary about this writing. I was so excited that I called our freelance fiction editor, Mr. Maurice DeWalt, on the phone. He read a lot of the slush material for us, and still does, and read him the story. He had the same feeling that I did, that here was a major talent in the making. I was not at all surprised by Stephen's subsequent success, and still am not, although the scope of it is a bit mind-boggling. We never did much editing of his work. I recall one time we didn't like the ending of a story, or there was something that had to be eliminated because it didn't fit somehow, and I called him. He asked that he be allowed to make the change, which he did. Cavalier pays on publication, but on occasion Stephen would call and ask if we could pay in advance, and we always did. He was having a difficult time financially. Stephen was always a very friendly, easygoing, grateful, and accommodating young man who came down to New York fairly frequently, and he'd come to my office. We got to know each other fairly well and had lunch occasionally. He was a big, warm teddy bear with a very boyish, impish grin and absolutely serious and dedicated to his writing. From the very beginning, he struck me as someone with a purpose, and he was never deterred from that. My last direct contact with Stephen was when he called me here in Florida and asked me if I knew of some out-of-the-way place where he and Tabitha and the kids could go just to get away. I called Sanibel Island on the west coast of Florida and found them a house to rent for a week. The island was, at that time, very private and somewhat sparsely populated, and they had a wonderful time walking the beach and looking for shells. Sanibel's called the shell capital of the world because there are literally millions of shells on the beaches. He came back through Miami and came up to see me. Still the same friendly guy. Fiction editor DeWalt was invited to one of his editor's parties. I think it was for Dead Zone and was at the tavern on the green. DeWalt had never met Stephen and reported that he was gracious and funny and expressed how grateful he was to me and Doug Allen, the publisher, for our kindness to him in the early days. We did pay him a bit more than our usual rate after his first few stories, because we knew he was special. I think that was about $250 or maybe even $300 a story. By 1977, Stephen King was world famous, but was still the same gentle, nice, kind man he'd always been. And although I have lost touch with him, I'm sure he'd respond immediately if I wrote him. I think his lack of egomania is what still makes his books so wonderfully believable for his public. I find it a bit amusing, no, charming, that he still expresses gratitude to us for giving him his chance at publication. My attitude is one of gratitude for having the opportunity to have rubbed shoulders with genius, and there's sure as hell no argument that that is what he possesses in his genre, and to have my name included in some of his forewords and acknowledgments. We've never tried to exploit our association with Stephen, and never would. The mentions have all come from him. We also signed over all rights to his stories immediately upon request. But it's great to pick up a book by or about him and see my name mentioned. It was, and is, a pleasure to know him. Not just because of his fame, but because he is a genuinely nice human being. 13. The Bones of the Family Business. Writing. Of course it is the family business. Owen King on writing. Maine Sunday Telegram, July 24th, 2005. We've always been a family that cares very passionately about books. Our dinner conversation was literary conversation. And after dinners, often we would have a family book we'd go and read together. We would pass the book around. Our framework for thought was built around writers and stories and literary content and scene creation. So, in that sense, the book trade, not so much the art, but the trade, was constant conversation. Joe Hill, on the King Family. Vulture, May 2013. We are family. The typical American, according to one source, reads 5 books a year. The Kings aren't typical Americans. They're bibliaholics and consume books like the typical American gobbles down a Big Mac with fries. If there's one thing that defines them, it's their love of storytelling. So it's no surprise when a major profile, Stephen King's Family Business in the New York Times Magazine, focused on that theme. Consider the published novelists in the family. Stephen King, who in recent years has published 2 books annually. Tabitha King, who has published 8 novels, the last a posthumous collaboration with Michael McDowell, whose family approached her to complete his novel, Candles Burning. Joseph Hillstrom King, who uses the pseudonym Joe Hill, following that used by Joel Emanuel Haglund, a Swedish-American labor activist who has published 1 collection of fiction, numerous comics, notably the long-running series Lock and Key with illustrator Gabriel Rodriguez, and 3 novels with The Fireman, 2015, and Gunpowder, no date, next in the pipeline. Owen King, who published a collection of short fiction, edited an anthology, and published a novel, and Owen's wife, Kelly Braffett, who has published 3 novels. Naomi King is the exception and does not write fiction. The fiction writing gene, apparently, has now extended to the 3rd generation of the King family tree. In Susan Dominus's profile, Stephen King's Family Business in the New York Times, Joe Hill's youngest of 3 sons, only 10 years old, is working on 2 stories, Scrap and The Bad Thing, a title both his father and grandfather admire. Stephen King, upon hearing it, said, "I'm sorry, I might have to use that." Echoing his father, Joe replied, "I know, I had the same thought myself." Whether the family's talent is due to nature or nurture, genes or upbringing, is immaterial. I believe it's both. In terms of book sales, Stephen is the king whose book sales overshadow everyone else's, but Joe Hill, who taps the same vein, is the rising dark prince. As Joe told Vulture in 2013, Our dad is a really unique figure in the history of American letters. With Nos Foratu, I will have published 4 books in 9 years, which feels like it is pretty prolific, but isn't in our comparison to our dad. I think compared to most working professional writers, Owen and I are both about as prolific as any of them. Numbers, though, are only a small part of the picture. The American landscape, writ large, can be found in their various fictions. As much a family business as it is a family passion, they celebrate what John D. MacDonald said about their patriarch's fiction in his introduction to Night Shift. Diligence, word lust, empathy, and equal growing objectivity, and then what? Story. Story. Damn it, story. Story is something happening to someone you have been led to care about. That is the secret sauce in the King's fiction. It is all about people. In his acceptance of the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters in 2003, Stephen properly credits Tabitha as his inspirational force in his heartfelt acceptance speech. Stephen made it a point to go out of his way to praise Tabitha, even asking her to stand up so people could see her. The only person who understands how much this award means to me is my wife, Tabitha. When I gave up on Carrie, it was Tabby who rescued the first few pages of single-spaced manuscript from the wastebasket, told me it was good, said I ought to go on. My point is that Tabby always knew what I was supposed to be doing, and she believed that I would succeed at it. She was there during the early years when he wasn't Stephen King, the best-selling writer, when he was just an aspiring, hard-working teacher-slash-writer named Steve King, who earned $6,400 a year teaching, when he was perceived by locals as just another working Joe. Tabitha King. Just as Stephen had staked out Jerusalem's lot, Tabitha had staked her claim to Nod's Ridge, Maine. Depressingly, the sales of her novels compared with those of her husband's are, as she put it, a faucet to his river. It's an apt metaphor, which is not surprising given that Tabitha was trained as a poet. As Stephen has pointed out, Tabitha took her study of poetry seriously. He recalled sitting with her in a poetry class at the University of Maine at Orno, listening to the sophomoric scribbling of wannabe Sylvia Plaths, whose work reeked of pretension. But when it was Tabitha's turn, his attention perked up because she read a poem titled The Bear that was so good it immediately earned his respect. She wasn't screwing around. She was serious about her work, and it showed. Not surprisingly, her first book was a collection of poetry, Grimoire. Likewise, Stephen King's serious interest in writing was one of the things that attracted her to him. They were of like minds. He was, as she recalled in Winter's Art of Darkness, interested in getting everything he could out of school and writing his head off. And as Stephen recalled in On Writing, aside from her interest in writing, he was attracted to her. He appreciated her comeliness and down-to-earth qualities. Tabitha was a trim girl with a raucous laugh, red-tinted hair, and the prettiest legs I had ever seen, well displayed beneath a short yellow skirt. She was carrying a copy of Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. Also, heavy reading or no heavy reading, she swore like a mill worker instead of a co-ed. In other words, she was Stephen's kind of girl. She wasn't Betty Coed looking for a Mrs. degree. As King explained in an interview for Faces of Fear, he had no truck with snooty coeds whose lives revolved around superficialities. These little dollies were bopping into their 8 o'clock classes with 9 pounds of makeup on and their hair processed to perfection, and the high heels and everything, because they wanted husbands and they wanted jobs, and they wanted all the things their mothers wanted, and they wanted to get into a big sorority. Big deal. Tabitha King's novels include Small World, 1981, Caretakers, 1983. The Trap, 1985. Pearl, 1988. One on One, 1993. The Book of Reuben, 1994. Survivor, 1997. And a posthumous collaboration with the late Michael McDowell, Candles Burning, 2006. Sports fans will want to check out Tabitha's self-published book in magazine format, Playing Like a Girl, Cindy Blodgett and the Lawrence Bulldogs season of 93-94, 1994. Inevitably, the subject of Stephen's sales, when contrasted to Tabitha's, provokes an understandable reaction in the family. As she told People magazine in 1981, "I'd be nuts to compete with him." But as Stephen reminds us in On Writing, writing isn't about making money, getting famous, getting dates, getting laid, or making friends. Writing is about writing. And in the end, it's about enriching the lives of those who will read your work and enriching your own life as well. On Tabitha King, Harlan Ellison. There is a quality of kindness in her work that is missing from Stephen's work. There are a number of women writers I read specifically because there is a quality of humanity, a kindness in their work. Tabby's stuff is quite different from Stephen's, and in some way is far more mature. Douglas E. Winter. There is an aspect of her work in which she is a very strong regional writer, and I say that in a complimentary sense. We're talking about Faulkner, O'Connor, of a Steinbeck. There is regional power in her books. In other words, part of the power of her fiction is its setting, its people. It is a peculiar kind of setting. Now, on the other hand, I don't think that limits her powers, as it does some regional writers. I think that she's also very capable of communicating the peculiarities of that region to outsiders like me. I've read, for example, some other Maine writers who make the society so alien that essentially it becomes an alien society, and you don't feel that you understand that much about it. Joe Hill and the Bones of the Business. On June 4, 1972, around the time when Stephen King began writing a short story called Carrie, his first son, Joe Hillstrom King, was born. Joe, now divorced, has three sons, one of whom shows signs that the third generation of Kings may take up storytelling, the family business. In a competitive field like writing, in which every advantage is used by first-time writers to get ahead, Joe King adamantly refused to play the trump card. "Hey, I'm Stephen King's son." That got him in print as a teenager when writing a nonfiction piece that was published in the hometown newspaper, the Bangor Daily News. But it proved to be an object lesson when he realized it was published because he was King's son. Either he could ride in on his famous father's coattails, or he would be judged by his own work's merits and demerits. To his credit, he chose the latter. Early on, he asked his parents about what was required to legally change his name, which he eventually decided not to do. But he did submit under his real name, without the famous last name appended, Joe Hill, not Joe King. Securing a literary agent, Joe Hill kept his identity carefully hidden, but when he began giving interviews, people noticed the uncanny resemblance between him and Stephen King, at the same age, and tongues wagged. And, just like his father, who eventually came clean and admitted he wrote the Richard Bachman books, Joe Hill got to the point where denial was neither plausible nor possible. He admitted it after Variety broke his cover. For Joe Hill, in the beginning, writing fiction wasn't a bed of roses. It was a bed of thorns. A writer for Wired explained, "Much of Hill's early work was rejected by publishers, including several novels and dozens of stories, which he sees as the pseudonym doing its job. He did eventually break through with the short story collection 20th Century Ghosts and the novels Heart-Shaped Box and Horns, and is now widely acknowledged as a leading horror author. He's also come to accept that people will inevitably compare him to his dad. His latest novel, Nosferatu, is peppered with Stephen King references. Working in the same field and being related to a famous parent may open doors, but in the end, it's the work that's important. His fiction has garnered multiple awards, attesting to the quality of his work. A Ray Bradbury Fellowship, World Fantasy Award, the A.E. Coppard Long Fiction Prize, a Bradbury Fellowship, 3 Bram Stoker Awards, 5 British Fantasy Awards, including 2 for comic books with Gabriel Rodriguez and a newcomer award, an International Horror Guild Award, and the International Thriller Writers Award. In addition to 20th Century Ghosts, a short story collection that got him a lot of attention right out of the gate, he's published 3 novels, Heart-Shaped Box, 2007, Horns, 2010, and Nosferatu, 2013, and several comics, including the series Lock and Key, illustrated by Gabriel Rodriguez. In the pipeline, a novel for 2016, The Fireman, a collection of short fiction, Gunpowder, and a comic book miniseries with C.P. Wilson III, Wraith, Welcome to Christmas Land. In terms of his fiction, his work, in tone and style, closely resembles his father's to such an extent that their collaborations are seamless. They include the short story In the Tall Grass, the novella Throttle, and an unpublished short story, But Only Darkness Loves Me. If Stephen King suddenly stopped writing for some reason, perish the thought. He has said that Joe could pick up his unfinished manuscript and complete it. In another parallel, Joe Hill's fiction has also seen adaptation to the silver screen. Horns, starring Harry Potter actor Daniel Radcliffe, was released as a major motion picture, appropriately on Halloween Day 2014. Critics gave it a 50% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but fans took a shine to it and gave it a 94% rating. For critics who opine that Joe Hill capitalized on his father's commercial writing style, I would respectfully disagree. Hill's literary leanings recall the observations made by his father in Night Shift. Writing is a catch-as-catch-can sort of occupation. All of us seem to come equipped with filters on the floors of our minds, and all the filters have differing sizes and meshes. What catches in my filter may run right through yours. So each day I sift through the sludge anew, going through the cast-off bits and pieces of observation, of memory, of speculation, trying to make something out of the stuff that didn't go through the filter and down the drain into the subconscious. Louis L'Amour's obsession centers on the history of the American West. I tend more toward things that slither by starlight. He writes westerns. I write fearsomes. Joe Hill also writes fearsomes, and like his father, he's much in demand by collectors who snap up his signed limited editions from Subterranean Press, which has also issued some of Stephen King's limited editions. There's obviously crossover between collectors of the two writers, but Hill's audience understandably skews younger. On Joe Hill, Stephen King, when his son was 9 years old. The kid can write a story. He's really got the bones of the business. Stephen King on the movie Horns. I liked Horns for the crisp, bright cinematography, but what I loved about it is the fearless way it mixes humor and horror, creating an all-new taste treat. Daniel Radcliffe's performance encompasses both the laughs and screams effortlessly. I go to the movies to be entertained. Horns was big entertainment. Vulture, October 2014. Owen King. Joe's focused. He's got a good work ethic. He's everything that I'm not. There's a lot more forward motion coming from Joe's office than from mine, I think. We both work at it every day, like it's a job, but he's more confident. Vulture, May 2014. Owen King. We're all in this together. Well, the thinking goes, Stephen King writes horror, Joe Hill writes horror, so why wouldn't Owen King write horror? Because he doesn't. Owen, born on February 21st, 1977, attended Vassar College, like his brother, then went on to get a MFA at Columbia University. His first book, We're All in This Together, was a collection of short fiction, published in 2005 by Bloomsbury, USA. His second, a novel, Double Feature, was published in 2013 by Scribner, which also publishes his father's fiction. In interviews, Owen makes it a point to inform readers that anyone looking for a horror fix in his work are bound to be disappointed. As he told Christian A. Larson, thehorrorzine.com, I've said this before and I'll say it again. Because I have the greatest affection for my father's work and the greatest appreciation for the readers who have read it so enthusiastically, whose money put clothes on my back and paid for my education, I do not want to give a false impression about the kind of things that I write about. This isn't because I'm embarrassed by my father's career or subject matter. It's because the last thing I want to do is to leave anybody feeling cheated. Author David Thompson, writing in the New York Times, called Double Feature, a novel that is epic, ambitious, and dedicated to the uncontainable. The novel is maybe a third too long, chiefly because as he wanders around, King can hardly see a place, a face, or a chair without embarking on a wordy, if not literary, description of it. This might have been cut by someone. Why not King? Who can see that brevity is his best quality. But he may be a tricky man to edit or organize. He should persevere, for when he is good, and that is often enough to make a page-turner of this book, he has a captivating energy, a precision and a fondness for people that are rare and that make the reader doubly impatient for him to do what he does best. Thompson's perceptive review suggests that Owen's fledgling novel shows great promise and that he is a writer to watch. On Owen King, Joe Hill. I sometimes think Owen is more architectural about his work. The pieces fit together and there's an almost perfect stitching there. Vulture, May 2013. Kelly Braffett, a novelist and Owen's wife. I can't even come close to approximating how wild and cool his ideas are, so I'm going to stop trying. But his finished work combines that wild, sparkling inspiration with true, heartfelt emotion that's always right on key. Lit Park, August 2006. Kelly Braffett. I'm a writer. I swear a lot, and I write dark, creepy books about people who also swear a lot. Trying to succeed in the publishing industry while navigating the fairly choppy waters created by all of these factors swirling around me has been, and continues to be, an experience that swings from exhilarating to infuriating from one split second to the next. Kelly Braffett. Kelly Braffett, a relative newcomer to the King family, has published three novels, Fabulous Things, 2005, which was retitled and republished as Josie and Jack, 2005, Last Seen Leaving, 2006, and Save Yourself, 2013. Kelly is painfully aware that life is too short to waste time reading books that can't hold her attention. I already probably own more books than I can ever reasonably finish before I die, she told My Bookish Ways in August 2013. If a book feels too familiar to me and the prose isn't blowing me away, I might put it down. If I have to force myself to pick it up, I might put it down. She never had that problem with Stephen King's fiction, though, which she first encountered in high school. In 1990, wrote Susan Dominus of the New York Times, when Kelly Braffett was a high school freshman in western Pennsylvania, her parents gave her for Christmas a Stephen King Book of the Month subscription. It was just what she wanted. She was in her Stephen King completist phase, and she was trying to track down hardcover copies of his more obscure books. By now, it's a certainty that she's got them all, even the obscure ones, since she has access to the original source. Stephen King is her father-in-law, and because he values her opinion, she's one of his early readers who gets a copy of his latest manuscript for which he solicits feedback before sending it off to the publisher. She talks easily and openly with her in-law, but it wasn't always that way. The New York Times noted that Braffett was nervous about meeting her future in-laws, nervous even at the sound of Stephen King's voice on Owen's answering machine. "It took me 2 years before I could actually speak in front of Stephen, Tabby." Her first visit to the King family home, which is in Bangor, was unnerving. All those endless rooms and hallways, like a real-life version of the hotel in The Shining, and that crazy famous fence around their home, with its wrought iron bat and cobwebs. Their underground library was bigger than the entire library in the town I grew up in. It was a lot. Between the two of them, Tabitha and Stephen King, there's a lifetime of reading and writing. Both are now accessible resources to Braffett. So for her latest novel, Save Yourself, when she was worried that she lost her way, the two gave her time-tested feedback. Tabitha provided structural advice, Stephen some notes on language. Mostly they told her to keep going. She's kept going and never stops. On Kelly Braffett, Owen King. She understands that writing requires constant fuel, sugar, Triscuits, hugs. At unpredictable times, Kelly often pops into my office with these things. She's an incredibly insightful critic. She's sympathetic to the primary difficulties of the job, rejection and uncertainty. Lit Park, August 2006. Book list on Save Yourself. Braffett's excruciatingly rendered characters and locomotive plotting make her a writer's writer, though this novel shows all the signs of a popular breakthrough. Sex is the driving force here, as power, as weapon, and as shield. And the sweaty mechanics of a few characters recall Tennessee Williams, perceptive, nervy, and with broad cross-genre appeal. Part 3. Doubleday Books. Magic Time. The Making of the Master of Horror. 14. King's Classic Books. An Overview. Business is all about relationships with people. This is especially true in book publishing, which is a close-knit community. Everyone knows everybody else, because editors frequently change publishing houses. Though authors occasionally gripe about their publishers, the marketing department, the advertising department, and others, they rarely complain about their editors, with whom fast friendships and lasting bonds are formed. King, who found a friend in Bill Thompson, had gotten a country music calendar from him in December 1972. In an essay, A Girl Named Carrie, Thompson wrote, "Country wasn't trendy then. But he and I were both buffs, and I thought he'd enjoy knowing Earl Scruggs' birthday. But I also wanted to hear from this talented writer whose letters I enjoyed and who was going to make it as a published author." Thompson sent the calendar off, along with a note. "What have you been up to lately?" King responded with a thank you and a query, asking if he'd like to see a new manuscript. Because King could barely afford to buy paper to feed into the typewriter, he was typing his manuscripts single-spaced, which editors hate because they want room to make editorial comments and corrections. But the single-spaced manuscript went off to Thompson, and the Kings crossed their fingers. Maybe this time. Magic Time. The Future Lies Ahead. The script was Carrie. And it was magic time, Thompson wrote. In an interview conducted by Stanley Weyotter and Peter Straub at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention, held in H.P. Lovecraft's haunting grounds, Providence, Rhode Island, King explained, "But in a way, with those early novels, I felt like a guy who was plugging quarters in the machine with the big jackpot and yanking it down. And at first, they were coming up all wrong. Then with the book before Carrie, I felt I got two bars and a lemon. Then with Carrie, bars across the board, and the money poured out. But the thing is, I was never convinced that I was going to run out of quarters to plug into the machine. My feeling was, I could stand there forever until it hit. There was never really any doubt in my own mind. A couple of times I felt like I was pursuing a fool's dream or something like that, but they were rare." After reading the manuscript, Thompson requested a rewrite on the last quarter of the book, which King admitted in On Becoming a Brand Name didn't work. "I knew what he was talking about. Tired and anxious to finish, the last 50 pages of the original draft bore a strong resemblance to a best-forgotten John Agar horror picture called The Brain from Planet Arras." King dutifully complied. Thompson's suggestions were right on the mark, as King wrote in On Becoming a Brand Name. "It was as if he had seen the corner of a treasure chest protruding from the sand and had unerringly driven stakes at the probable boundaries of the buried mass." In other words, Thompson could see the direction in which King was going with Carrie, and his editorial suggestions helped King get back on track. The result was a manuscript that was ready to present to the editorial board, which had the final say. In February 1973, the rewritten manuscript went back to Thompson, who recommended it for publication. Then King took a bus from Herman, Maine to New York City to meet Thompson. The country mouse went to meet the city mouse, and with only $10 in his pocket and a return bus ticket home, the country mouse, who wanted to put his best foot forward, bought new leather shoes to make a good impression. He couldn't afford taxi fare, and walked from the Port Authority bus terminal near Times Square in New York City to Doubleday's offices at 277 Park Avenue, a long walk, a mile away. When King arrived at the skyscraper housing Doubleday, Thompson took the impressionable young author to lunch, along with his secretary, and King had the first of what would be many publishers' lunches. King's recollection is that, among other topics, they discussed the possibility of Carrie's selling. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King recalled, "I asked Bill to estimate the chances that Carrie would be published by Doubleday. He told me he thought they were 60 to 40 in favor." The editorial board was the final hurdle. If he cleared that, King knew he was home free, and a first-time published novelist. But if they passed on it, as they had his earlier submissions, he was back where he started, living in a writer's nightmare with 1,500 pages of unpublished manuscripts, his hopes dashed, and his prayers unanswered. King took the bus back to Maine. It was an 11-hour ride to Bangor, and from there, a half-hour ride to Herman. All he could do was go home and wait for the word. It was out of his hands. As Thompson wrote in an essay, A Girl Named Carrie, published in Kingdom of Fear, "I was determined to see Carrie published, but this time I downplayed reactions from editorial colleagues in favor of the profit center types, sales, publicity, subsidiary rights." When the editorial board met to discuss buying Carrie, Thompson knew the book had gotten a thumbs up when the advertising manager called it a cooker. King was home free. His talent, persistence, and bridge-building with editors would finally pay off. Knowing the Kings had no phone in their trailer on Clot Road, Thompson sent a telegram in March or April, addressed to Stephen King at RFD No. 2, Box 499D, in Carmel, Maine, 04419. It read, "Tell, Bingo. Carry officially a Doubleday book. $2,500 against royalties. Call for glorious details. Congratulations. Love. The future lies ahead. Stephen King recalled in On a Brand Name that Tabby called me during my free period at school. I went up to the office to take the call, aware that it was necessary for her to go next door to make the call, and quite sure that one of two things had happened. Either Doubleday had decided to publish Carrie, or one of the kids had fallen down the front steps of the trailer and fractured his or her skull. In an interview in The Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia, Chris Chesley vividly recalls the day that changed the King's lives forever. Steve was living in Herman then, and I was again boarding with him. I would hitchhike from Herman to Orno and back again at the end of my school day. So one day I hitchhiked home, and I came down this little dirt road that his house was on, and I had just gotten in the yard when Tabby ran out the front door, and she was waving a telegram. "Look, look at this." She handed me the telegram. It was just a few words, and I read it. And Tabby jumped and shouted, and I jumped and shouted, and when Steve got home, I got out of the way. They just hugged each other and cried. I could hear them from the next room. Not that I was eavesdropping, but you just couldn't avoid it. It was one of the best days that I have ever spent. They were just thrilled to death. Carrie was going to be published. They moved out of Herman and moved into an apartment in Bangor. Changes. Tabitha King's recollection of the move from Herman was a little more grim. In a collector's edition of Carrie, she wrote that it was the end of a cycle for us, though we didn't know it. We got evicted from the trailer in Herman and moved back to Bangor. They moved into a second-floor walk-up apartment with four rooms in a modest house at 14 Sanford Street, which rented for $90 a month. But at least they could afford a phone now. The house has since been torn down. Despite the book sale, Stephen King couldn't afford to simply quit teaching. The $2,500 was an advance against royalties, and once the book was published, the publisher would wait a half year to gauge and report sales and then give him a royalty check if the book's advance earned out. The original advance was only $1,500, but Thompson got it goosed to $2,500. Now nearing the end of his second year of teaching, King had two more months left on his contract to finish out the school year. King hoped he would be leaving the teaching profession behind him, just as he permanently left behind what he termed shit work, the low-paying, menial work that paid the bills when he was in high school and college, as well as after college. Janitor, bagger, dyer and sewer in a textile mill, gas station attendant, and laundry worker. The kind of poorly paid work his mother had also stoically endured after being abandoned. Therefore, that summer, he planned to write and hoped to make another book sale or more sales to Cavalier, because the Kings always needed the money. The book advance could only stretch so far. In a cover letter dated April 20th, 1973, King returned the contract for Carrie and wrote that he could see himself in a big yellow Cadillac and hoped Doubleday could sell the rights 40 different ways. They weren't sold 40 different ways, but there was one significant sale, and it would make all the difference in the world. It would change his life forever. As it had turned out, NAL, New American Library, made a preemptive bid for Carrie, to keep it from going up for auction, fearing it had set off a bidding frenzy. The bid shut the auction down even before it started, and soon King would get the good news. On Mother's Day, May 13, 1973, King got a phone call from Thompson. The news was that the paperback rights to Carrie had sold to NAL for $400,000. King, by contract, would get half. King had suddenly and unexpectedly been catapulted to instant success. Flabbergasted by the news, King felt he had to somehow mark the moment and decided to buy Tabitha a gift. He walked to Laverdiere's Superdrug on Main Street and bought her a hair dryer for $16.95. When she returned home and asked what it was for, as King recalled in On Writing, she didn't appear to understand. I told her again. Tabby looked over my shoulder at our shitty little four-room apartment, just as I had, and began to cry. Chris Chesley, who was still living with them at the time, recalled that night when Stephen King got home, which Chris discussed in an interview published in a King zine, Phantasmagoria. He went over the contract with King. He stroked the neck of his beard and grinned like a pimp as I kept poking my finger at one pretty clause after another. Percentage for foreign sales. Percentage for film deal. Percentage for t-shirts. Stephen King sat and grinned like a man capable of high and fancy rolling. I remember looking up from the contract and watching him finish his beer. He started talking about the second draft of Second Coming. Soon he had got up and went to work on it. Down the hall in the little room with space enough only for him, his typewriter, the loud furnace, and the louder radio. The kids came in while he banged the keys. As it got dark, in the kitchen, Tabby sang along with Steve's radio. I remember the carton of cigarettes still gracing the living room table. The packs fanned out, gleaming luxuriously under the ceiling light. David Bright, who was King's editor at the Maine campus when they were both students at the University of Maine at Orno, was now a reporter with the local paper, the Bangor Daily News, in which he reported the news of King's breakthrough sale. Steve King can't quite make up his mind whether or not he should retire. For King, the book marks his first hit after three strikeouts in trying to break into the novel business. That the book is about Maine high school life is no coincidence, for King wrote his first book while in high school himself. His first rejection, along with a letter that perhaps he should try another field of endeavor, came that same year. King says teaching often takes up time he'd rather spend at writing. Five of his students at Hampton Academy have asked his advice on novels they are writing, and he is encouraging them as best he can, which is one of the reasons he hasn't decided to quit teaching, despite his newfound fortune. A Good Story, 1974. In a letter sent to reviewers of Carrie, Doubleday wrote, "Doubleday is pleased to present you with this special edition of Carrie by Stephen King. We feel it may be the novel of the year, a headlong narrative with the drive and the relentless power of The Exorcist, with a high-voltage shock of Rosemary's Baby. More than that, it is part of a rare breed in today's fiction market, a good story. Don't start it unless the evening in front of you is free of appointments. This one is a cooker. Carrie is the story of a girl who has been the odd one all her life, the misfit, the born loser. Torn between her fanatic mother who sees sin everywhere, in the nudity of a girl's shower room, in any friendship Carrie might develop with girls her own age, and especially in dating, and her own pathetic wish to become part of the world that shuns and attracts her, Carrie becomes the butt of every cruel joke, the object of any malicious prank. But Carrie is different, more than a victim of forces she cannot understand. She possesses a strange and frightening power, which she can hardly control. And when one final prank is played, the unleashing of Carrie's power proves as spellbinding as it is devastating. We hope that Carrie will excite you as much as it has us. A tremendously readable ESP novel, it is also a quietly brilliant character sketch of a young and unusual girl trying to find her way out of a very personal hell. We think Carrie and Stephen King have a bright future, and we welcome this chance to share both of them with you. 15. William G. Thompson, Another Good Angel. Most of the books I liked seemed to carry the Doubleday imprint. I particularly liked one of their novels, The Parallax View, by Lauren Singer. So when I finally had a manuscript ready, I addressed it to the editor of The Parallax View and sent it off to Doubleday. Stephen King, 1981. Acquisition editors serve as reconnaissance scouts for their publishers, ranging far ahead of the main body to find new writing talent. Sometimes the talent comes to them. Sometimes they search authors out. The stakes are high. Finding, nurturing, and publishing the right author can be a windfall for the publisher. As the saying goes, publishers make books, but authors make publishers. King is certainly right in saying that. In the mid-70s, Doubleday was a book publishing powerhouse. By his estimate, Doubleday was issuing 500 books annually and had its own book club as well. King's initial thinking was that their sheer volume meant they were always on the prowl for new writers. He was right in thinking so. In fact, publishers are always on the lookout for fresh, new talent. They can't get enough to suit them, and regrettably settle for less. It's a seller's market if you've got the goods, as King does. In King's case, he was fortunate, indeed, to get William G. Thompson for his editor, if only by default. The editor of The Parallax View was out sick for the day,